The Vet Tech Cafe is a podcast centered around veterinary technicians and nurses. We strive to discuss current issues facing our profession and give our colleagues a voice and a medium to enter into these discussions. Our guests are experts in the veterinary field that we hope can help our listeners work towards dealing with these issues, as well as coming up with solutions that can lead to change. If you have a question or a comment for us, please contact us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. And now, here are Dave, Jeff, and another amazing guest on the Vet Tech Cafe. Hello, everybody. Thank you very much for coming by the Vet Tech Cafe today. We're very excited about our guest today. We have Liz Houston coming by the Vet Tech Cafe for a chat. If you don't know who Liz is, first of all, what rock have you been living under? But second of all, she's a veterinary technician specialist in both small animal internal medicine and emergency and critical care. In addition to her work as a consultant, a trainer, relief technician, she provides cannabis harm reduction education for veterinary practices and owners nationwide. She's co-founder of the Veterinary Cannabis Academy with Steven Sital, who we also hope to have on the Vet Tech Cafe sometime in the near future. She serves in several leadership positions throughout our industry and is currently the president of the National Veterinary Professionals Union and co-chair of the Internal Medicine VTS Academy Credentialing Committee. Her latest endeavor is something that we're going to talk a lot about today, which is the Not One More Vet Support Staff movement, which launched last month. It's, if you're not familiar with it, it's a suicide prevention and mental health support group that's on Facebook and is a division of the Not One More Vet movement. Of course, this is a huge emerging topic in veterinary medicine. There's lots of data and research coming out currently about suicide rates, comparing veterinary professionals to people at large in society, and some of the numbers are staggering. And Dave, you and I kind of talked about, when we started actually with interviewing guests, we talked about maybe starting with some lighter topics and some things to kind of get us going and not really go right off the deep end into to such a touchy and deep subject. But here we are in our first official episode going with suicide. And
yeah, it's one of those topics that is at the forefront right now, especially with the launch of the Not One More Vet support staff Facebook page that has gotten a lot of success and just the amazing stories that have come off there. It's just so heartbreaking. And, you know, it's one of those things where we think that, you know, it's not going to happen to us, but I think everyone around that's in our profession has been touched by somebody that has gone through this.
Absolutely.
So I think it's really important to talk about.
Absolutely. And if you're in this field long enough, even if it's not somebody you know personally, it's probably somebody you've at least heard of professionally, or, you know, maybe read one of their journal articles or seen them lecture at a conference, or, you know, somebody that knows somebody. It's staggering. And, you know, of course, with as available as some of these stories are in 2019, now approaching 2020, it's more familiar to everybody. So I think we both felt it's something that we just need to really jump into. And the mental health aspect, you know, we hope to have a lot of different people on the show throughout the course of this podcast talking about different aspects of it, and compassion fatigue and burnout and all kinds of things. So,
like we said, this is kind of what we want to talk about on this podcast, is issues that are affecting techs today. And clearly this is one of those topics that we really need to talk about. We should probably get right into it and welcome Liz. Liz, thank you for joining us on the Vet Tech Cafe. Can we get you a coffee? How do you like your caffeine?
Yes, I would love a coffee, actually. I'm very lucky in that I live with a wonderful husband who makes my coffee for me every morning. So I am a latte girl, so I do like a nice strong coffee with a little bit of whole milk, you know, warmed or steamed whole milk. That would be lovely. Thank you.
That's fantastic.
Right on. I
love that
this.
Coming right up.
Yeah. I love how specific that is. So, Liz, a large part of why we're doing this podcast is to discuss, like, different career paths, right? Like, you know, different paths people have available to us, because so many people, we work in clinics for so long, and we just kind of feel trapped, or we maybe feel we get to a point where we just don't know where to go next. And mm-hmm. yours is a path that is very far reaching. But I kind of want to start at the beginning a little bit. So you have your master's in education. So what were you doing before vet med? Why did you change to vet med? And what was the spark, or what got you going to set this whole profession on fire?
Yeah. Oh, God. Thank you. I I actually was one of those little girls who always wanted to be a veterinarian. So from the time I could say the word, that's what I was telling people I was going to be. That's what I wanted to be, was a veterinarian. And I had a lot of good experiences with our family veterinarians as I was growing up with our family dogs. And it kind of solidified that for me. And that was my big focus. And all through high school, I really was focused on all of the science classes. I took, you know, AP everything. And then I did a summer program at a prestigious East Coast university that was for high school juniors. And I went there, and I went to a very small high school. So this was the first experience for me of being, instead of at the top of the group, right, in the top 10%, 5%, whatever, I was firmly in the middle, maybe the bottom of the middle of the group of people that were there. And it was my first experience. And you know, when you're 17, I mean, a lot of your listeners, if they're vet techs, they're probably much closer to 17 than I am now.
all three of us.
Yeah, well, you can remember how that feels, you know, that then you start questioning everything because you've never been in that situation. And because you're a teenager, you feel like you don't have anyone to talk to about it, because how could anyone else understand what you're going through? So I made a very drastic decision at that point in time, and decided, I looked around and said, what else do I like to do? What am I good at? And so I decided to be an English major. And so I became an English major, and that's what I went into college as, and graduated from UCLA with a bachelor's in English. And that was in 1992. So that was the height of the That was the height of the recession. You couldn't get a job, and you certainly couldn't get a job with a degree in English. So I thought, well, what am I going to do? And my boyfriend at the time was a math major, and he was going to school to become a teacher. So I thought, oh, okay, well, sure. I like to teach. I really did like to teach. I always have liked to teach. So I thought, okay, I'll do that. So I went to school and got my master's in education, my high school teaching credential. And after my year, actually semester, so half a year of student teaching in high school, I decided, okay, that's not for me. High school teaching is definitely not my path. And then I graduated with my master's degree and didn't want to teach. So then I was like, oh, what am I going to do? I got a job with the Santa Clara County Bar Association. My father was an attorney, and I had worked for an attorney during college for, you know, my college job. And so that was a nice place for me to land. And the job I had, I really loved, because I took care of people who thought they had been charged unfair legal fees, and they would come to the Bar Association, and we would set up an arbitration process for them. The arbitrator panel was a public member and two lawyers, and they would decide if the fees were reasonable or not. So I felt like I was really making a difference, which was great. And I did that for about 4 years, and then got, I guess, kind of bored and looked around and thought, well, what else? I felt like, okay, I know what this job is. What else is there for me to do? So I worked for the CEO of a software company, and I did that for 4 years. And that was an amazing experience in the middle of Silicon Valley, where I live, working for basically a startup software company and taking them from just before their IPO, through huge, I mean, like exponential logarithmic growth.
Was it something that we would recognize?
They were actually purchased several years ago. The company was Siebel Systems, and they were bought by Oracle. So now they're part of Oracle. And so you probably recognize Oracle.
Yeah. So
that was an amazing experience. And what that did too is it gave me the ability to, when I stopped working there, to take a little bit of time off. And I decided by that time, we had adopted this really wonderful dog that we had adopted from the Humane Society. And I decided to volunteer at the Humane Society to kind of give back, because we had this wonderful dog. And, you know, I hadn't lost my love for animals or my interest in science and medicine or any of those things during this whole time. So I started volunteering, and I was very quickly moved from the like doggy walker, doggy behavior kind of folks into the health check area, because I just was kind of expressing interest and I was really interested in behavior and all of those things. And I started working in this health check area where we would test litters of kittens for FIV, right? And we would do the assessments. We had an assess a hand, right? So we'd feed dogs and then we'd put the rubber hand in there and see if they bit the hand. So making these determinations about whether dogs would be adoptable, or making those kinds of determinations, which I really, really enjoyed. And it was really firing me up. And I thought, oh, I could see myself doing this long term, or I could see myself trying to get a job at the Humane Society. That would be really cool. And one day in the health check area, there was a woman there observing, and she was wearing scrubs, and I didn't know her. And I looked at her name tag, and it had her name, and it said veterinary technology. And I said, "What's veterinary technology?" And she said, what she said, which I try not to say, and we're not going to get into this controversy, but she said, it's like a nurse for animals.
Right.
And I said, "Oh, really? I didn't even know that was a thing." And she said, "Yeah, there's the school she went to. It's like just north of where I live." And I said, "That the school's right there?" She's like, "Yeah, it's right here." And I said, Oh my God. Okay. And I went home that night and applied for the program. And at that point in time, it was pretty competitive. It's still pretty competitive. It's that at a community college, that Foothill College in Los Altos Hills in here in California. And I thought, well, if I don't get in, then I was going to be a doula. So that was my other thought, was I was going to help ladies have babies. So
I was just going to ask what a doula was.
A doula is like a mother's helper during birth. So I thought, okay, I'll do that, because that was something else I was really interested in, kind of moving towards like medical adjacent, right? I thought, oh, that would be a good area for me. And I ended up getting into the Foothill program, and kind of the rest is history now. So the Foothill program is 2 years. So it's a set 2 years,
right.
for 8 quarters, I guess, or really 6 quarters. And I just fell absolutely in love with veterinary technology and with veterinary medicine. And I feel so lucky that I found it in that way, because I don't know what I would be doing now if it wasn't what I'm doing.
it's funny to think about that.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I know you guys, the last couple episodes when you've interviewed each other, which are the first couple episodes, I really enjoyed listening to you guys and hearing you talk. We've talked through the years about like, where do we go with our career? What do we do?
Mm-hmm.
I know I'm in the minority of people who think I don't want to do anything different. I want to find something within veterinary technology, using my knowledge, using my passion for the patients, my passion for the people in this career, to move the career forward and to find something to stay in. And I know so many people who like leave for human nursing, or leave for all kinds of things outside of the veterinary medicine for lots of different reasons, which maybe that's a good segue for us to get into the different reasons, because it leads straight down the road to mental health.
That's a good point. So just to take things back. So after you became a technician, fast forward to 2011, 2012, I want to say.
2011, I think we sat, right?
Yeah.
Or did we sit in 2012? I can't
2012.
Remember. Dave and I sat for our VTS ECC exam the same year. I think it was 2012.
It was 2012.
Because I sat 2013.
Yeah. Yes.
At that time, when you and I met, you were, and this was unbeknownst to the group until probably a little bit into it, that you were also studying for small animal internal medicine and took the exam like halfway through studying for ECC.
Yes.
So A, are you crazy?
Yes.
And B, how difficult was that to do? Was there a lot of crossover knowledge that was applicable for both of them? Or was it more of a, I'm gonna do both of these things at the same time and get through it all?
I mean, I think it was a little bit of both. I knew that I had an interest in both areas. I have no interest in surgery or anesthesia. and those were kind of the other big VTS academies at that time. There were some other smaller ones that were way outside of my area of expertise, like equine, for example. But when I looked at, so when I was kind of trying to decide, well, which way do I want to go? And I looked at the skills list and the knowledge list for each specialty academy, they're so close for ECC and IM. There are some differences, but they're very close. And so I looked at the deadlines and I looked at like when the exam was going to be, and I thought, I think I can do both. And now they've since changed the rules, and you actually have to wait a period of time in between your VTSs, which I do think is a really good idea.
Okay. I didn't realize that was a thing now.
And I think part of it is the idea that can you truly specialize into different disciplines. You know, in my case, where I think by the nature of the hospital where I worked, so I used to work at Adobe Animal Hospital in Los Altos, and it was a 24/7 general practice with emergency ICU. I was really and I did not work in surgery at all. So I really was doing medicine and emergency and critical care. That's really, I mean, that was my job, was those two right. things. So I truly was specializing in both of those things. Maybe a little bit more emergency than medicine. We didn't have any internists on staff. There were no specialists on staff when I worked there. So we didn't have any diplomats, but we did have an endoscope, right? So we did a lot of scoping procedures right. and things like that. And we worked with the referral hospitals. So we would end up a lot of times doing the management of these cases with the veterinarians consulting with the internists, but we were doing the medicine part. So it's a nice partnership, the way that the hospital works with the referral hospitals in the area. And for the staff, it's really amazing because it gives us the opportunity to do a lot of advanced veterinary medicine in that kind of setting. So we had technicians who were mostly focused on the kind of general practice side, what we called the outpatient area. So the people who would deal with those folks who come in for their regular appointments, for wellness exams, all of those things. And then we would have us who were dealing with the emergencies that presented, dealing with the critical patients in the ICU, including patients on ventilators and all that kind of stuff. So it's a very interesting amalgam of a practice that really let me do that. There aren't a lot of practices around that operate in that way. So I can see the point of the CVTS, the Committee on VTSs for NAVTA, to make that rule that you have to wait, because the idea that a person could specialize in two different things at the same time, you know, you have to say, most of the academies have a rule that you have to work like 70% of your time in that specialty. Right. And I was doing that just by virtue of that, of the way that practice was structured.
Yeah,
But your first question, yes, I'm crazy. It was a dumb idea. I should have talked to somebody about it before I started. Because basically for 3 years, there was nothing but veterinary right. medicine. Yeah. And it was either IM or ECC, and I didn't read anything that wasn't veterinary related. I didn't do anything. I had basically no free time, so to speak, because everything was focused on preparing either the application, which is a huge task in and of itself, or the studying and preparing for the exam. And I think one of the things about these exams for people that makes them so difficult is you have no idea what to expect. You think you're a good test taker, so it'll be fine. Like I'm really good at multiple choice tests. Like why do I need to study? And I've never taken a more difficult exam than those two exams for the academy. That was surprising to me. And I think it's surprising to everyone who sits for the exam. So I think that was, you know, it was just all consuming. And then there was a lot of the anxiety because there was some unknown stuff, like what's the test going to be? And then just the waiting is hard. You turn in your application, then you have to wait like 2 months yeah. to find out if your application is accepted. And then you study and then you sit for exam and you have to wait like 6 weeks to see if you passed. And it's difficult. And I really do feel bad for my husband because he really took the brunt of all of it, you know, mm-hmm. We'd be sitting together in our living room and the TV would be on and he would be watching it and I would be reading a veterinary journal or a textbook or whatever. So yeah, it was difficult, but there was enough overlap. And the knowledge, again, is very similar between the two groups with specific differences that I was able to accomplish it. Thank goodness.
It's interesting because, I joined, the year after you guys did, and we've only come, a few years since that time, but how much things have already changed. Like in our group, a lot of people that had tested the year prior talked about, having to stalk the mailman for acceptance letters and things of that sort. And here I come along, the first time I take it, we just get an email saying, it's amazing how quickly things change. And now we're going with, all digital applications. There is no more creating a binder or creating a manila envelope or submitting one part digital and having to compile all of these papers that you and have all to the, print all out the printing. And hope you, you don't have to run to Staples in the middle of the night to
four
get a new
binders,
ream of paper.
Four binders. And then I had to send them via FedEx to make the deadline. Yeah. Oh, my gosh. It was so stressful.
Very stressful.
Yeah. So with kind of keeping in that, you already maybe answered this a little bit, but so of course the two VTSs at the same time has gone away. I think they've now said, you know, whatever the academy requires, if it's 3 years or 5 years, you kind of have to wait that time. And so I definitely see a path though where ECC and IM and maybe a couple others overlap, because as you were describing at Tufts, our ICU is kind of the hub of the hospital, as you will. Mm-hmm. I don't do anything with surgery, anesthesia, but we have, I mean, I could easily make an argument that I work a huge percentage of my time on medicine patients.
Right. If they're non-surgical, they're medicine.
Right, right.
Exactly. Even post-op care is medicine.
Yeah, so, and our department splits. We both work ER and we both work ICU, and it's I mean, they're just separated by a swinging door. So, you know, we have a ton of neuro patients in there. We have a ton of onco patients in there, but they're, you know, they can all, now, you know, yes, I could absolutely see you can't do cardiology and neurology at the same time.
No. I mean, and that's the thing, right? I hear from a lot of people because of my role in lots of different Facebook groups, to be fair, but I hear from a lot of people who say, oh, I want to specialize in behavior and ECC. And, I, you know, I'm like, I tell them realistically, that's really difficult to do because they're very different. And the expectations of each of those is very different. And you cannot do 70% of your time in practice in both of those. It's not possible, right?
Right.
Because you have to, for behavior especially, it's so behavior intensive. It's so much client focused. It's so much developing training plans and building that kind of stuff. Not that we don't do behavior medicine in emergency. We absolutely do. And we have to be focused on behavior. But it's totally different. They're such different disciplines. But that is really different than ECC and IM.
Well, and the other part of that is going on behavior in ECC is probably a poor example of this, but to get your ECC VTS and then suddenly to stop and you do 70% of your work in behavior, what are you doing with your ECC?
How do you recertify?
And
that's
recertify?
The other big thing that I remind people that there's a CE requirement for every academy. So there's a CE requirement for application, but then the recertification is a big thing. Yeah. And actually, for me, that is, believe it or not, that is something that has kind of helped to keep me in the profession longer and kind of keep me engaged and motivated. And Jeff, you kind of talked about this a little bit in your interview, volunteering with these organizations, right? So volunteering to serve on your state veterinary technician association, or volunteering with your academy, because you were the credentialing chair for AVECT, right? Or for ECC, or still are.
Yeah.
So, you know, that kind of stuff, even though it can be frustrating and it can be challenging and it takes time, it keeps me engaged in the development of the profession and in where the profession goes, what the direction that we take. And that I find that incredibly motivating for me. So.
Yeah. And, you know, if you see a problem, it's really easy to sit back and point it out, but take the initiative and try to be part of a group to make an effort to make it better.
Right. Exactly.
So,
so one last thing before we start to switch into some more serious stuff. And I think I probably know what the answer is here. As you see it now, Liz, what are some of the biggest challenges that you see facing the veterinary technician profession?
Oh, my goodness. There's so many.
Yeah, right.
There are so many. And, you know, some days it feels so overwhelming to think about all of the issues that we're facing as a profession.
Right.
And I think for me, one of the biggest things, and it kind of dovetails into a lot of different things, but one of the biggest things for me is utilization of veterinary technicians to the fullest extent of their license, skills, education, credentialing. And I think that's a huge issue in the industry. And I think that if it's kind of a chicken and egg argument. I feel like if we were fully utilized, our value would be much more obvious to veterinary practitioners, veterinarians, and I think then our pay would be more commensurate with our contributions to the practice. I think veterinarians would be happier because they would be able to focus on veterinarian things, getting the doctor things that they are supposed to do, getting them done without having to work 60, 80, 90 hours a week. And I think technicians would be happier because they know that they're contributing to the overall success of their practice, of their doctor, of their teaching hospital, whatever it might be. And then if they got paid, I think that would be a big step in the right direction too. Mm-hmm. I mean, the big issue here, or a couple of the big issues, but of the big issues, one of the biggest is these large corporations have come into our industry, to veterinary medicine. They're buying up practices, and some of the people in the leadership of those organizations don't understand the value of veterinary technicians. And they look at veterinary support staff, so including everyone, right? Kennel assistants, veterinary assistants, credentialed veterinary technicians, front desk staff, they look at them as completely disposable people, in that they think of it as a stepping stone career, as opposed to a veterinarian, which they think of as a career, mm-hmm. I guess, with career in quotes, right? But I know from working with the union and working with these groups that are trying to negotiate contracts, they've had people from these corporations sit across the table from them and tell them that they, you know, this is a stepping stone career for you. They're a stepping stone job. It's not a career. And they're saying that to people who've been doing this job for 20 years, to veterinary technician specialists who have invested huge amounts of money and time in their career. And you can't call it less than a career. But until veterinary medicine as a profession as a whole, and I think the corporations have a big part in this because they own so many practices, until they look at us as a viable, at our profession as a viable career, that it's not a stepping stone. This isn't working at, you know, American Eagle to make extra money so that I can go to the movies, right? This is my life's work, truly. Yeah. And until there is recognition of that from veterinarians, and I'm talking about from the AVMA down, and it really does have to start at the top. And it is just now starting to reach that level where they're really starting to recognize that if they don't start paying attention to veterinary technicians, if they don't start utilizing them and paying them appropriately, we're going to stay in this cycle. And Jeff, you alluded to this in your interview. We're going to stay in this cycle of constant turnover where we're losing huge amounts of knowledge and skill every 5 to 7 years. They're just draining out of our industry, and you cannot sustain an industry like that. Then you put on top of that the mental health challenges, the wellness challenges. I really do believe that fully utilizing staff members to their fullest extent would take a lot of pressure off of veterinarians, because I do appreciate that they are under huge amounts of pressure from owners, from their debt load, you know, and by owners, I mean pet owners, from their debt load. If they own a practice, the burden of having to take care of all the people that work for you, you know, it can be really, really challenging. But I think if one was able to delegate better or well or whatever, right. And really utilize, really push technicians to achieve the things that they can do with their license legally, it really frees you up to do the important work that I believe veterinarians should be focusing on, right? Talking to clients, delivering those prognoses, making diagnoses, doing surgery. Those are all things I absolutely cannot do, but I can do everything else in the clinic, and let me do everything else so that you can focus on those things. And guess what? We all get out of work on time and we all are much happier. Well, yeah, that's in GP, right? But I really do believe that would take a huge burden off. And I think it would take a huge mental health burden off as well. Yeah.
That's a really good point.
Yeah, it is. And I think, you know, some of those skills that you mentioned, especially you use the word delegation. I think that's one that is one of those soft skills, if you will, that absolutely. I mean, we were kind of talking before we started recording today, you know, how a lot of this, I think some of these corrections can be made in academia before we even really let these people graduate as veterinarians.
Definitely.
and kind of teach them a little bit better in some of those areas. And, you know, I used to tell, when I taught vet tech ed when I lived in California, I used to tell my students on the first day of school, because I had them the first semester and I had them their first day, I used to congratulate them on starting tech school, because I felt that was the difference between having a job and having a career.
Yeah.
And if you want to do anything in this profession, whether it's become a VTS, whether it's, you know, if you have, you know, legal interests and you want to work with state associations or whatever it might be, you have to start with becoming credentialed. And that's the stepping stone to all this. And
yeah. And I think your point about academia is so valid. And, you know, it's nice to hear that from someone on the inside. And I've talked to lots of technicians who work in veterinary teaching hospitals. That is where we have these moldable mm-hmm. minds of veterinary students to really teach them what it is to work as part of a veterinary healthcare team.
Right.
Not just to be a veterinarian, but to lead a team of veterinary right. professionals right. to provide gold standard levels of care. Yeah. And I was shocked to learn that there are some veterinary schools in this country that don't have credentialed technicians on staff. They just hire assistants and they right. use their students mm-hmm. as workers yep. in their hospitals. Yep. And I'm not saying that veterinary students shouldn't be working in the hospital. I think they need hands-on time with animals. I think they need to learn observation skills. And the best way to do that really is taking care of inpatients.
Sure.
But you got to have credentialed technicians on staff
yeah.
because you have to model what a yeah. true, what a practice looks like.
Looks like, absolutely.
And you have to teach veterinarians how to work with these other professionals. Yeah. We teach veterinarians, well, maybe we don't, Jeff, you should tell me, but we should be teaching veterinarians how to work with specialists, right? How do you work with referral hospitals? How do right. you work with, you know, a surgeon? What is that like? What is the relationship like between a GP veterinarian and an internist or a surgeon or a criticalist for that matter? What does that relationship like look like and how can you manage that? And it should be exactly the same with their staff. How do you manage a staff of customer service reps, kennel assistants, assistant, you know, veterinary assistants, and credentialed technicians? And then if you're lucky enough to have one of the 1,100 of us in the world who are VTSs, if you're lucky to have one of us on your staff, how do you use that person? What are they best?
Right.
What is the best place for them in your practice? And how can you utilize them appropriately, effectively to maximize their value to you as a veterinarian? And those are the kinds of things that I think AVMA accredited vet schools would be really well served mm-hmm. in teaching veterinarians, instead of how to place IV catheters or how to put an animal in the right position to get a diagnostic radiograph. Like
right.
that doesn't make any sense. Don't spend a week on that in school when I spend a whole quarter on radiology. That's
right.
my job, is to know all of that stuff about radiology so that I can provide you with doctor with the tool that you need to make a diagnosis, which is your job, because I can't make a diagnosis. That's
right.
your only job. Well, you have four, but that's one of your four jobs.
Yeah.
So like, but it's my job to help you get you the information you need to make that decision. So I would love to see the veterinary curriculum change. And I feel like I don't have a lot of power in that, except that I know a lot of people who do work in academia.
Yeah, I guess the big question for that is, well, we've recognized what the problem is and where it needs to be fixed.
How do we
access that, and how do we start those
yeah.
conversations?
Right.
It's really difficult. And, you know, it's difficult for a couple of reasons, but one of the big reasons is, in my opinion, the AVMA won't allow technicians to join the organization. It's very difficult to join the AVMA. I'm not saying it's impossible. It's difficult. There should be an affiliate level membership for credentialed veterinary staff and veterinary assistants if they wanted to join. It shouldn't be as difficult as it is to join the AVMA. And I think without technician voices at the table, it is difficult for them to hear these concerns and then to make educated decisions. Now,
right.
some folks may say, well, NAVTA is there. NAVTA has 4,000 members. And there are about 100,000 technicians and assistants in the mm-hmm. country. So they have to reach out more broadly to get more perspectives. The message is getting through. It's just a matter of getting the right ears, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true. And it's, you know, I think in so many ways, it's just whatever we want to talk about, you know, it's always where do we start? And,
right.
you know, once you kind of have that first conversation, then you kind of start to gather momentum and hopefully you can meet the right people and have the right conversations. It's just, you know, that where do we start and how do we start and hopefully
and I
we
think
can
that actually that yeah and I think that's such a good segue actually into the mental health discussion, because one of the things that we did when we got involved with Not One More Vet, so For those of you who don't know about Not One More Vet, that was a group that was formed after Sophia Yin committed suicide. So Sophia right. Yin was an yeah. amazing behavioral right. veterinarian out of UC Davis. And she committed suicide 5 years ago. Yeah. And at that time, it was a real shock to everyone in the industry because she seemed entirely fulfilled. She was at the peak of her career. She had an enormous amounts of influence. And, you know, no one knows really what her struggles were.
And I might add a behaviorist, right?
Yes,
I mean,
exactly. Yeah,
somebody that devoted her life
right.
to, I mean, of course, animal behavior. But,
right.
you know, that was her thing.
Yeah. So a group of veterinarians started, they really started this organization from the ground up where they said, we just can't allow there to be one more veterinarian who does this, who feels right. alone, who feels like they don't have resources, that they don't have anyone that they can reach out to. We can't let this happen again. So they started a group called Not One More Vet. And they started, it was a Facebook group and peer support. And initially, when I first started hearing about it, I tried to join and was told that support staff wasn't allowed to join. And that made me very upset. And I expressed my displeasure. You know, the fact that we are under a lot of the same pressures.
Right.
We don't have the exact same pressures. I think that the debt load alone is very different between mm-hmm. most veterinarians and veterinary support staff. The kinds of decisions and pressure that they get from owners, from pet owners, pet parents, whatever your preferred term is, can be much more extreme on the veterinarian side. And I think that the societal pressure and the support pressure, your family support, is much different. That pressure is much different for a veterinarian than it is for a support staff person. So in a way, you know, we were talking about how we're not really respected as a career. And in some ways that works to our advantage because we can feel a little bit more freedom to change careers or paths or jobs. And veterinarians, I think, when their family, right, or even the public society looks at them like, you spent all this time, you did 4 years of college, you did 4 years of vet school, if you're a specialist, you did an internship and a residency, and now you don't want to do it anymore, like, what? It becomes very difficult to change paths. And so I think those pressures are immense, and it can be very difficult for a lot of folks to deal with those. So the more I thought about it, the more I get that, okay, yeah, veterinarians kind of need their own space to deal with those issues because they're way different than ours.
That's true.
But it doesn't negate our need right. for peer support
right.
and for suicide awareness and suicide prevention, because we are being affected by it as well. And in fact, just 2 weeks ago here in California, just south of where I live, a technician took her own life in the bathroom of her practice. Oof. And yeah, it's just, so I mean, it is happening to us. We are subject to a lot of the same pressures. And aside from that, you know, perhaps there are some, and this really deserves more research, perhaps there are some underlying personality types or something that draw people to veterinary medicine. And maybe there are some mental health challenges in our population that are different than the general population. And I think that deserves some research. But all of those things being said, so I was really upset about this. And to your guys' point, you know, so you can be upset about something, but like, do something about it,
right?
So, so during, I don't know if it was mental health week or something, but I was bemoaning the fact that the AVMA talks a lot about veterinarians and they don't talk about support staff at all. And there's no support for support staff. Where is the support for us, for our side of the profession? And, somebody reached out to me and said, oh, we're starting a Not One More Vet support staff. And, I said, okay, what can I do to help push this over the finish line? Let's get it out there. Let's make it happen. And so they brought me on to kind of the steering committee group, and then we were able to launch it, as you said, last month. And the group has been heartbreaking and heartwarming at the same time. The amount of support that we have for each other has been amazing to see. we all, those of us who are moderators of the group, all went through QPR training, which stands for, oh gosh, as, of course, as soon as I said QPR, I was like, oh, now I have a mind blank and I can't remember what it stands for. But it's basically, it's suicide prevention training. So we question people. There's this myth that talking about suicide makes people more likely to think about suicide, which isn't true.
Oh boy.
People who are thinking about it are thinking about it.
Right.
And talking about it doesn't make them more or less likely to think about it or to act on those feelings or thoughts. But what talking about it does, it bring it out into the open and gives you an opening to have that discussion with someone about why they're thinking about that and to help get them resources and help. And that's really what the group is about, is providing that peer support so that people don't feel alone. And I know in Not One More Vet, in that group, they have prevented several suicides. They, you know, people might post in the group that they're having ideation, you know, that they're in a dark place, that they don't know what they're going to do. And the group mobilizes their resources. And in fact, in some cases, has even contacted local authorities to intervene. And so it truly, the organization is truly saving lives.
Right.
And I am just so happy to be a part of it and to see the support that is really just, it's amazing. I mean, you guys are both in the group.
Yes.
It's incredible for me to see the amount of people that rally to other, to
yes, exactly,
to people's posts.
One of the things that I really love about that Facebook page is, I don't know how you did this or how it actually works out, but the anonymous posting, where someone can post their story anonymously. I don't know if that goes to the moderators and then they submit it as an anonymous post. But I feel like that's an amazing way for people to get their story out there without having to attach their name to it, where they get that support, they get that peer help, without having to actually put themselves out there. Because, you know, that's one of the big things is having that outlet so that they can express their feelings and express what they're going through without having to be looked at differently. And some of the stories that I've read on there are, you know, I don't know how much involvement the Facebook page has with those people that submit anonymously, but it's got to be really helpful for them to actually be able to speak about these things that they can't really, they don't feel like they're comfortable talking about with their friends, their family,
right,
or their coworkers.
There's so much shame around mental health issues.
Oh, of course there is.
And luckily, I mean, thankfully, we're moving into a time, I think, where that's starting to go away because people are talking about it. And the more we talk about it, the more we talk about our struggles, what we're facing, if we have mental health challenges, putting it out there is so powerful, both for yourself and for the other people who are dealing with the same thing, because it lets them know they're not alone and that there are other people dealing with it and you can get help with resources. And that's the other thing I think, like, we could have just started a mental health support group, right?
Right.
And there are a few
right.
other groups on Facebook that are there for mental health. But having the backing of Not One More Vet, which is an actual 501c3 charitable organization.
Oh.
And so we have things like, there's a benefit. If you're a member of this group, you can get free online counseling, a month's worth of free online counseling. That's amazing. We now have a new peer support network. So you can call a hotline and be connected with a peer support person who is backed up by social workers and other mental health support and societal support so that they can actually connect you with real world resources to help fix whatever it is you're dealing with. So that kind of thing I couldn't do by myself. So being able to be brought into the Not One More Vet family and organization has made it so much more powerful than it would have been if we had just tried to start it on our own.
Right.
Yeah. You know, one point you brought up that I think is kind of interesting in terms of like the debt load. Certainly the dollars, you know, in terms of education for veterinarians is different, but also their earning power is.
Yeah.
It's really proportionally, you know, for what veterinary technician education costs versus what an entry-level credentialed veterinary technician may make in certain areas, proportionally isn't that different. So yes, while the dollar debt load may be much higher for a veterinarian, the amount of debt for what a new credentialed technician may make is still not that proportionally.
You're
it's not
totally
that far
right.
off.
Yeah. You're totally right.
And so it's really a bummer. One thing I want to ask about, so of course, somebody I think that's a huge advocate for both technicians and for suicide prevention, and that is Dr. Andy Rourke. And he had a survey out a couple of months ago about controlled substance use in practices in veterinary medicine. And I think, I know I participated in the surgery, or the survey, excuse me, you guys both probably did as well, in terms of like how controlled substances are used in the practice. And then he put out the results and, you know, talked about the whole four eyes save lives idea. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, I'm, you know, I wasn't a part of that initiative, but I certainly am a proponent of it. And I think Dr. Rourke caught a lot of flack when this came out, as any, I mean, I think anyone who's out there, right, catches
right, right.
flack. That's what
right,
happens.
Yeah.
I've been reading a lot of Brené Brown lately, and she talks about, there's a Teddy Roosevelt speech she talks about being the person in the arena. And when you're in the arena, you're the one doing the fighting, but then you're subject to all of the slings and arrows of everyone else because you're the one doing the fighting. That's a very, very loose paraphrasing of the quote. But regardless, so he took a lot of flack for it, which I think was misdirected. You're not going to cure the mental health problem in the veterinary industry by putting a sticker or a magnet on your controlled drug box. But what this Four Eyes Saves Lives program does is it encourages people in the practice to think about how they handle controlled drugs, particularly lethal controlled drugs. So propofol, which in some places is controlled and some places is not, but can definitely be lethal. But mostly it's euthanasia drugs. So these drugs, putting them in a place, either in their own box or having some kind of a system where you never have only two eyes on that bottle. You never have only one person pulling that bottle out of the box and taking it somewhere. I mean, that's a whole thing too, right? Don't take your controlled drug. Don't allow your controlled drugs to go places in your practice.
Right. Yeah.
So the idea is that you always have more than one person when you're dealing with your controlled drugs at all. So in some places, and I don't know, maybe Tufts has a Cubex. So that's a big machine.
Yeah, we have an OmniCell.
Same thing, right? So you can set up those machines so that certain drugs need to have two employee codes or two thumbprints to access the drug. What that does is it's a stopgap. Is it going to stop every single suicide? No, it's not. But it is a physical barrier to getting your hands on a method to be able to kill yourself.
Right.
And I think that's the important part of Four Eyes Save Lives. And and the idea, and I put a magnet on the lockbox in the practice where I do GP, and there some of the flack he got is the idea that when someone sees that on the lockbox, it makes them think about committing suicide. But we know, and I'm sorry, committing suicide is actually an old term. It makes them think about taking their own life.
Right.
And we know that that is not the case. People who are suicidal, who have suicidal ideations, are thinking about it. Giving them a visual reminder of a crisis hotline, that they are not alone, that the things that they are dealing with are temporary, that suicide is a permanent solution to a temporary problem. And if we can remind them of that, and that's part of what QPR training is about, is to remind people that there are people who care about them, to think about their impact in their practice, in their family, in their community, and to stop themselves from taking that step, that final step, and instead picking up the phone and texting the crisis line or calling the suicide prevention line. And the beauty of those services is they're totally anonymous. They're solely to support you through a crisis, and they're free. And that is so important to have available. And I know a lot of places don't like the idea of putting it on the drug box, but they put it in the bathrooms, which I think is a really good idea. You know, like if you have stalls, there are crisis line numbers on the backs of the stalls, so that when you close the door, there's a crisis line number right there.
Right.
Suicide prevention. And I think those things, just starting there, right? It's literally the bare minimum you can do, right. But it's something that you can do. Then I encourage practices, if they can, if they're big enough, if they have the resources, to create an EAP for their practice, so an employee right. assistance program. Those programs are definitely not a cure-all. They have a whole host of problems, most around the fact that they don't provide a whole lot of coverage. But for crisis intervention, they're invaluable.
Yeah.
And to be able to have somebody that you can reach out to.
How the magnets that you talked about, how would somebody go about getting that for, like, should yeah. We should put that out to, I'm assuming they're free?
Yeah, they are. They're the magnets, I think, cost $2 or something like that, but the yeah. stickers are free.
Okay.
And we can put a link, I'm sure, in the description of the podcast,
exactly.
And you can get them directly from Dr. Rourke's website.
Oh, okay.
So I think it's drandyrourke.com or drrourke.com, but we'll put the exact link yeah. in the show notes. The stickers are free, I believe. So, and then I think like the magnets cost maybe $2. So,
you know, it's kind of tragic, because the idea of him catching flack for that is just so short-sighted. You know, he referenced one study, and I'm ballparking the figures from what I can recall, but you know, it was roughly 3/4 of people. In one study that he referenced, that had attempted suicide and were not ultimately successful, so yeah. they were interviewed for the study. About 3/4 of them contemplated suicide for less than an hour.
Yeah.
And somewhere in the neighborhood of 50% of people, almost every other person, contemplated suicide for less than 10 minutes.
Yeah.
And so that whole idea, right? It is a stopgap. If we can prolong that time and get somebody to think about it for just a little bit longer,
right,
we might save a life. And the thing is for that practice, they're probably never going to know whether or not they saved a life, right? There is no
right.
tangible way
right.
to know whether or
you're
not
never
this
gonna,
practice
You can't prove you're
worked.
Negative, right?
But,
unless someone comes to you
right,
and says,
but the
you know
flip
what?
Side of that,
that,
if somebody
sticker,
did take
I was
their life in the practice you work
to take
at,
out the pink juice and I was going to go inject myself
I don't even
the
know what I would do.
And unless they come and tell you that, you would never know.
Right. Right. And who's going to
tell you?
Who's going to tell their supervisor
because
that I was contemplating
I
was honestly contemplating taking my life last night.
Right.
I mean, I would certainly hope that they would, but that's unrealistic.
Yeah, it's not feasible.
Yeah.
Right. And that's the other part of Four Eyes Save Lives, right? It's not just the sticker, and it's not just how you deal with controlled drugs, especially euthanasia drugs in your practice, but making sure that no one is ever alone in the practice.
Right.
Which,
right.
in our field, veterinary medicine is a team sport. So really, we never should be alone in the practice.
Right.
There's no
yeah.
reason for us to be alone in the practice.
Sure. There's a million reasons not to be.
Yeah. There are right. a million reasons not to be. Exactly. Yeah. So that's the other part of it, too, is thinking about it from that side. And if we think about it from that side, it takes us further down the mental health road, right? Why are you in the practice by yourself?
Right. Yeah.
What is it about your time management, or about your staff utilization, or about your, you know, appointment management, or whatever it might be? What is it that led to you having to stay there without other people? And those things are underlying issues that need to be addressed and fixed as well.
Yeah, it's true. It's just, it's so much, there's so many layers to this. It's just,
yeah,
it's
definitely a multifactorial problem. It's going to require multifactorial solutions, right? We have to hit it from a lot of different avenues. I'm happy to be part of one group that is trying to do something. And I think there are lots of other groups that are out there trying to do things too. And I think if we can hit it from a lot of different angles, I don't think we'll solve it, but I think we'll make it better.
Yeah, I think that's the whole thing, is just the more we talk about it, the more ideas are going to come to the forefront.
Right.
And the more angles we approach that from, you know, the more relatable it's going to become,
yeah.
and hopefully remove some of this stigma.
Yeah. And the more people we get involved, right?
Right.
Because we
right.
really needs to be, we need to have a lot of people involved if we're going to fix it.
Yeah, it's true.
Well, and I think we're now at a stage where it's not an excuse anymore to say, well, I don't know anyone that would do that.
Right.
Because
right.
clearly it's everywhere.
Yeah.
It's a huge problem in our profession. And we thank you for going after it.
Yeah.
Because
well, you know, you guys know me. I don't
yeah.
do anything without
true.
Going at it all the way. So
that is 100% true. All right, Liz. Well, I think that's about our time for today. We really thank you for being on the Vet Tech Cafe. This was fantastic. This is kind of exactly, I think Jeff will agree, this is everything that we wanted it to be. We are trying to tackle issues that are affecting veterinary technicians. And even though this topic is really deep and really very emotional, I feel like it's important to get ahead of it before we lose one more vet staff or one more vet.
Agreed.
So we appreciate you being on and talking with us about this. So now we're going to transition into our little exit interview thing here.
Okay.
Something that we are trying to get a hook, I guess, for lack of a better term.
Okay.
And what we're going to have is we want input from our listeners, and you can email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. And what we're trying to get is random non-veterinary questions that we can ask our guests to kind of put them on the spot at the very end.
Okay.
And Liz, for your non-veterinary question that Jeff and I decided was good for you. So, Liz, if one day it was discovered that you were arrested and put in jail, what would your friends and family assume you had done?
Oh, God. Is it multiple choice?
Oh, no. No.
Completely open-ended.
Oh, my goodness. I mean, I think my friends, if the news got out that I was arrested, I think most people would think that I had probably assaulted someone. Maybe to the point of sending them to the hospital, maybe not. But that, I think... That would probably be most people's guess, that that I just went off on somebody. I lost it.
You know, as I was thinking of this question for you, I'm like, it's probably going to be assault.
I mean, so I throw it back to you guys. If you heard I had been arrested and you didn't hear what it was for, what would you guess?
Oh wow. Ooh, you're throwing it back at us. This is a new twist.
Yeah.
I would have said assault.
Yeah.
I don't know why, but I was thinking speeding, like, really, like.
That's so funny, because that was the second thing I would have said, like driving 150 miles an hour on the freeway. Yeah, that would have been the second thing. But then I'd probably assault somebody, because I'd have road rage, right?
That's why you were speeding, was to catch up to them, right. To assault them.
I'll tell you, I have a much longer drive to work now that I'm teaching, and I'm driving at 9 to 5 hours. I understand road rage now. Because
it's bad. And you live in an area with not a lot of traffic. Come to Silicon Valley.
No thanks.
No, thank you.
All right, Liz. Well, thank you so much for your time today and for talking about this. Really, I mean, this is just the first conversation of many. And there's a lot of other things that we want to have equally deep dive conversations with you about. We want to talk about the union. We want to talk about the Veterinary Cannabis Academy. So we hope to have you back on periodically throughout, because you're such a focal point of so many of these things. So we hope you had a good experience today and you'll come back at some point. But thank you so much.
You guys are fantastic. Thank you so much. And
as
I've told you in private, I will now tell you publicly, I just am so proud of both of you for doing this, and so happy that there's a podcast that's really focused on our side of the profession. And thank you for that. And I think it's really needed. And I'm really looking forward to seeing where it goes and to listening to your following conversations.
Us too.
Thank you, Liz.
All right. Thank you, Liz. Have a good one.
Thanks, guys. Bye.
Dave and Jeff would like to thank you for listening to the Vet Tech Cafe podcast today. As we talk about difficult issues facing our profession and chat with colleagues who have strong opinions of those issues, we feel it is important to note that the opinions and views expressed by Dave, Jeff, or our guests on the Vet Tech Cafe podcast are solely theirs and theirs alone, and do not represent any other person, business, institution, or any other entity. If you have any questions relating to this, please email us at vettechcafe@gmail.com. Thanks again for stopping by the Vet Tech Cafe.